Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Our weekly conversations always include you. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. If you call us from Oahu, the number is 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, you can participate in the conversation by calling 877-941-3689. You often see the studies ranking the best places to live. There are usually common elements to those questions, boiling down to the impulse many of us have to live in a people-friendly environment. That often means some open space, affordable quality housing, and maybe some preserved farmland for sustainable agriculture. Urban design can be a grassroots activity with communities participating with design professionals. In Honolulu, though, that doesn't always seem to happen. Tonight, we look at who and what is shaping the city and county of Honolulu. Here are our panelists. Professor Luciano Minerbi is here. He is a faculty member of Urban and Regional Planning. He has taught at the since 1969 and teaches land use, environmental management, cultural assessment, and sustainability in Hawaii and the Asia-Pacific region. He consults for international, national, and local groups and organizations, and he has served on the State of Hawaii and City and County of Honolulu Neighborhood Boards. Annie Koh is also here. She is a Yale and Seoul National University Graduate School of International Studies graduate and now a Manoa Department of Urban and Regional Planning doctoral candidate. Her dissertation research looks at the use of temporary projects in the making of place identity in urban Honolulu. She's involved with many community planning projects, including the Inter-Island Terminal, the Kaka'ako Agora. Jennifer Dara Okike is also here. She is a sociologist, lecturer, and graduate faculty affiliate at Manoa in the departments of sociology and urban and regional planning. One strand of her research has looked at public participation in urban development. She also teaches and conducts research on housing policy, racial and ethnic relations, and sociological theory. She was born and raised on Oahu and recently returned with her family after receiving her PhD in sociology from Brown University and doing a teaching stint at Harvard University. And of course, you're here too. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We've got a whole brain trust around this table. If you have a question about urban planning, now's the time to call. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to start with you, Professor Minerbi, because you have spent a lot of time in Honolulu, and you've seen a lot of changes in all the time that you've been here, too. If you look out and just gaze around town, what is it that you would say characterizes Honolulu now?
That Honolulu miss opportunity to plan land use and development in a way that would be sustainable, affordable, consistent with the small island ecology. And it's possible to pinpoint what went not so well in the past, what went wrong, so that we can learn better how to deal with the future.
I want to come back to that pinpoint in time, but for you, Jennifer Dara Okike, what do you see when you look around at Honolulu?
In some ways, I see opportunities for a great experiment in public involvement in planning and land use decision making, because unlike many parts of the United States, there are more opportunities in Hawaii because of our distinctive land use regulatory system for moments of community influence, moments of public participation.
Annie Koh, weigh in on this too.
I was just thinking about how, I live actually quite close to this station, and there's so many cranes. There are the ones down by Ala Moana Center, there are the cranes all over Kaka'ako, and they seem to sort of symbolize this particular kind of value of land, right? The land value is something that's for sale. It's a property that can be bought and sold in a market. And at the same time, here in Honolulu, there's a very strong sense of value of land that's quite different. That is a connection to ancestry. That is a place to grow food, to feed. And so I think there's a little bit of that moment of there seems to be a disconnect from the physical environment and then the actual values that we hold dear.
Professor Murphy, I wanted to get back to your point about a missed opportunity, and that you said that we can pinpoint. Where is that?
I've been trying to understand where are our major mistake, and we are all at fault. The first one, I think it is dealing with the population projections. We have a good estimate of population projection done by demographer and economist. However, these population projection, I am afraid that they are taken critically by the top decision maker of the state and the legislation, because they are a very technical projection based on complicated input-output model. And so this projection become, unfortunately, self-fulfilling prophecy. What has been extrapolated becomes what is desirable and what is to be planned for. Then taking these population projection as key, all the line agencies, public and private sector, plan to make those self-fulfilling prophecy. And what is tragic is that these good economists and demographists very clearly say in their report that you can read that those projection can be changed if the decision maker find that are not appropriate. They are just based on strong demographic and economic forces. So what's happening is that the county, I believe, don't have the power to control this population target. The only things they can do is to distribute the population throughout the island. That's what the city and county of Honolulu and the other island do. So this is the first major giant problem. And the second one, unless it's the first, we are talking about planning today among us. However, the problem is, I believe, taxation. I have the feeling that the county must rely too much on property taxation to provide goods and services and run the government. So they are the most developer-oriented among the level of government.
Go back to your first point when you're talking about self-fulfilling prophecies and population extrapolations that move over time. We've been told for such a long time that we are so behind the curve with housing. Is that true in your mind?
Oh, definitely. Somehow we are not provided with detailed information about housing need and housing demand is not the same things by different income groups. We are given a total figure and then we embark into project to meet that overall figure that ended up to serve only the interest of outside investor that wanted to park their money into very profitable development in the state of Hawaii. Instead, we need a more accurate description of which segment of the population need housing and see how that segment can be helped out. For example, people that can save a little could have a government program that allow to to get a mortgage that is more favorable to them. They would be fire people, police, teacher, working people, basically. And in other words, what I'm saying that for each segment of the housing need of population, there is quite different way to meet their needs so that becomes effective demand.
That doesn't play into the just the total amount that we're usually given when we're behind the curve by X number of thousands of units every year, and that begins to snowball, but it's not necessarily serving the populations that you've broken down into different categories.
Yeah, so there could be self-help housing for a category. There could be small contractor for another category. There could be programs for union people, teacher, worker in different category that they can pool their resources and build housing. There is opportunity for limited equity housing cooperative. We have it in the Hawaii revised statutes, but we are not using them because we don't understand what it is. The bank don't know, the developer don't know.
Why don't they know?
Well, because they are not interested in exploring different way to really meet the housing need. But we have some developers, some people that provide housing for this segment. So I hope that...
Annie and Jennifer, jump into this. You've just heard what Professor Minerva's been talking about. How do you assess his assessment? Annie, go ahead.
I think there was a major shift at the federal level in terms of housing funds, and I think that really decimated affordable housing, public housing availability in many cities, including Honolulu. I also think that as kind of our economies globalize and housing markets become not just about satisfying the housing needs of the people who live here, but they also become investments, right? So then instead of housing as shelter, it's housing as a way to invest and then earn money later. So there's sort of a tension between those different uses of housing. And so I think, you know, something that's really incredibly important to consider is that right now our primary way of funding affordable housing on the island is by sort of setting aside a percentage of a market rate development. I think on one level that feels great because, hey, the city and county doesn't have to spend any more money and it's coming out of an existing development. But it also sort of creates this funny logic where, you know, we're relying on the market being a booming market, right? You want the sort of property market to be up and up and up in order to fund these affordable units, which means that we're making the entire sort of system less affordable. So it's this funny, you know, you'll get a few units that are affordable, but you won't necessarily allow the whole system to stay affordable.
Which doesn't seem to be addressing the need that Professor Minerva was just talking about and that we've been talking about as a larger conversation for years and years and years. If you're just joining us tonight on Town Square, we're taking a look at who and what is shaping the city and county of Honolulu. If you have a question, we have a UH Brain Trust around this table, and they'd be more than happy to answer your question. Or if you have a comment about what you're seeing and how you feel we might be able to move past some of that and be able to create the Honolulu that might well serve its entire population, call us 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We have Professor Luciano Minerva, who is here, Annie Koh, who you just heard speaking a moment ago, and Jennifer Dara Okike, and you too, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The issue of affordable housing, also having the safeguard for agricultural lands, all of that, we've seen that just churn and churn and churn, and not just with Ho'opili and what may be happening out on the Ewa Plain, but just in general trying to assess what's important land, what's not, how do you bring people into the, you know, the core of Honolulu and build that up so that people are living and working and playing in the same area. We've heard those arguments for a very long time. Is any of this really working in a way that you see as a positive stroke, or have we, as Professor Minerva is suggesting, fallen short by talking about it but not necessarily taking it to the level of detail that would really make a difference for certain populations. Go ahead.
Well, I can say something about this. The land utilization on the island of Oahu. In 1937, the Territorial Planning Board indicated in a map all the land that was utilized in various type of agricultural production. And I have it right here for you. What happened is that we have been covering the best agricultural land with mainland subdivision standard. That has been the third major mistake in the city and county of Honolulu. Back, I believe, in the 70s, there was a government planner, Ramon Duran, that was going around to explain that there was a pressure for development and would encroach the best agricultural land. It was a lonely voice in the community, together maybe with the League of Women Voters, and nobody among the planner actually articulated that to protect agricultural land, we should have studied the urban standards in terms of density of people, jobs, and building structure that would allow the city of Honolulu to develop in a continuous way, in a more compact way. Instead, what happened is that with Los Angeles standard, we suburbanize Central Oahu and Eva. And the way in which this was sold to the public was by saying, okay, going in Central Oahu and Eva, we protect the North Shore and the Windward side. Mm-hmm. So all those people said, okay, mess up Central Oahu and Eva. Now what happened is we are in this situation, and this situation is unsustainable because we impacted negatively the island ecology in an unsustainable way. And also this urban sprawl is extremely costly in terms of community facility infrastructure that have to be replicated. And so it is, a major disaster, and I am so upset because go against all the good principle of urban design and planning that I studied. And in particular, as a taxpayer, I am now saddled with the cost of paying for something that is not that good.
You just heard Professor Luciano Minarbi talking about how he's very upset at the way in which we've seen the island of Oahu developed, and that the fact that there were principles that have been ignored that would have been better put into place and have yielded perhaps a better place for us all to live. We want to hear what you have to say. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. You probably think about it on your commute, you probably think about it as you're going to places around the island or just looking at how one neighborhood looks very different from what's next to it, or that there's an urban area very much next to an industrial area that there hasn't been in some cases of urban planning. Well, the crew around this table might agree with you, but we want to hear what you have to say. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Jennifer, I want to have you comment on what you just heard Professor Minerva say.
Yeah, two things to add to that. One, some might add to that list that we've been relatively successful holding that urban growth boundary to some extent on the windward side. However, it's not a boundary that remains without intensive fighting that is ongoing. And of course, here I'm thinking about recent debates over the Ko'olauloa Sustainable Community Plan. And, you know, people, of course, take different stands on that. But, you know, it seems for the moment, at least, to have held back some of the pressure for building housing there in an area that has long been designated as a place for more rural kinds of land patterns. And I would add, secondly, you know, what's going well, what's going right. Over the decades, as a result of a lot of really hard work and advocacy on the part of Native Hawaiian communities, I think there are more tools, rightly so, available that are used to powerful effect to protect Native rights and to, you know, we've made some progress, I think not nearly enough, in terms of, you know, integrating into our legal codes and planning practices, again, because of a lot of hard-fought movement organizing, litigation. You have some laws with teeth that really make a difference in checking the incessant pressures toward commodification of land and the use of land for profit. So, for example, PASH, Kapa'akai, rulings which require state agencies to affirmatively look out for the rights of Native Hawaiians, Native Hawaiian descendants, cultural practitioners, and that kind of thing. And I think that's moving in the right direction.
We talked a moment ago about urban sprawl and the way in which Oahu developed. In some ways, though, wasn't that just very much a product of the times? And when you're talking about the 60s and the 70s and being able to be it all, have it all, and this great lifestyle and not feeling that people were being compacted into cities, however great that might be for us now. But isn't it somewhat very much a product of the times and something that maybe was perfectly fine then that now we look back and say, made a lot of mistakes?
I think there was. Oh.
Actually, I don't think so. Because when I came here in 1969, I was kindly asked by one trustees of Cumberland State if I would help to design the new town in Neva. And I was flattered, but I said I cannot do that because it is in the wrong place. Locating a new town in there, like locating a new town in Mililani back then, was not a good planning. Was simply real estate 101. It's called leapfrogging. If you obtain a rezoning from open space or agriculture to urban, from far away from the Honolulu proper, or the land in between, in the mind of everybody, regardless of the zoning, is considered potentially urban. So that's what has been happening here now. And that's why, actually, I think you mentioned that urban growth boundary. The city and county of Honolulu said that they were doing good planning because they adopted the urban growth boundary, an idea from Oregon. Not true. The state of Hawaii was the first state in the nation to have a state zoning that was defining where Honolulu should grow, the urban district, and the rest was agriculture and conservation. What we did instead, we just have been rezoning, so that the urban boundary of Oahu, I feel they are a joke for Central Oahu because they cover almost everything except the North Shore.
No one ever said that you don't speak your mind.
Not only me, but there was a planning director, one of my few heroes here, that said at that time in the 70s, I think was, that there was enough zoned urban land to accommodate the housing need and the people in urban Honolulu. What happened to him? They let him go. In the late 70s, I wrote an article, Designing Honolulu for Mass Transit. I was advocating to coordinate land use with transportation planning so we could have a linear city that will have high density, low rise, not high density, high-rise, not low-density low-rise. What did we got instead? Low-density low-rise with this cupola that is designed for the cars with single-family homes, so people will still need the car. That's why it does not work and is very expensive to fix it.
Which is apparently what we're all going to be finding out very soon. Thank you very much. I'm glad to have you here. See, a good thing that you have all that history that most of us don't have, whether we weren't born yet or just simply not aware of it. Thank you very much for part of that. I bet you've been around for a little while, too. Even if it's been 10 or 20 years, you've seen a lot of changes in Honolulu and on the island of Oahu. We want to hear what you have to say about urban and civic planning. What do you see in that? What would you like to see? And do you think what is happening now in any way is syncing up with some of what you think should happen? We've got a group of experts around this table. We're taking a look at what's happened historically, where we are now, and where do we go from here? We talked this morning on The Conversation about the Chinatown Action Plan, or summit rather, that is going to be happening on the 27th, and people gathering to talk about what might be a good solution for all the ills of Chinatown. How do you plan for that? How mass transit's coming in, all kinds of things. That's one area. There have been some other meetings around. Certainly the city's been trying to do some of that. But is it too little too late? Is it something that's possible to integrate into the vision that Professor Minerby has been sharing as we've been talking for about the last 20 minutes or so? But we do want to hear from you. We're going to go now talking to Joanne, calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Joanne. Thank you so much for your patience.
Oh, aloha. I'm calling from the neighbor island of Kauai.
And that's almost funny, considering what we're talking about. But sometimes you've got to have perspective, you know?
Well, I've been in politics since 1970s, and I know Professor Minerby. And my question is, if we look at what we can learn from Honolulu's mistake, isn't it really the governance system and the decision-making system that allowed landowners basically to determine land uses rather than a public process that was focused on the public interest?
Joanne, I'm getting a lot of nods around this table, and thank you very much for the question and for the patience to be able to ask it. Stay with us. We're going to come back to you in a second. Let's take that one first. I saw you writing a lot there. Jennifer, take it up.
Oh, it's a great question. And I think that's right on. I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges that exists, or what we might call these structural inequalities that Hawaii has the most concentrated land ownership in the United States by far. And of course, that's a result of the history, the history of land in Hawaii and the history of monarch control, but absolutely. And it's only right, therefore, that our policies and processes should do everything they can to even out the scales a little bit, if that's even possible. And I do think that we have pioneering policies and laws, being the first in the nation to establish the land use law of 1961, for example. And what I hear in the caller's voice is this, this sense from experience that it's not enough. It's not enough to counterbalance.
The Land Use Commission was not making decisions. It became just a second zoning to county zoning.
Right.
I mean, you just put two layers.
Right.
And they didn't play the role of actually controlling growth. So what went wrong?
Oh, I have an hypothesis. I have the feeling that the state planner, the economist, we are going to talk to the large landowner, and they were asking, what do you want to do with your land? And they would say, we want to grow housing. We don't want to grow sugar cane. And so taking down those notes, the economists were translating that into an effective demand for job and housing. And I have right here their model that very clearly indicate that if there was not enough people in the labor force to feed the jobs, they would come, that population from outside.
Literally, if you build it, they will come.
But
exactly.
What if you had done transfer of development rights and allowed the landowners in Eva and Kapolei to transfer rights? How would you do that? Into the Honolulu area where you wanted growth.
Thank you for asking about that, because it's very interesting. Transfer of development rights is written in the Hawaii Revised Statutes. It is on the book, but is not been used, really. The same things like limited equity housing cooperative. It is on the book, but is not been used. Again, that would have required monitoring what is done on the mainland, some experimentation, and that would have been the only way to develop a plan that would provide a windfall and wipe out more equitable for the landowner, all landowners, small and big. So this is the point. Thank you for mentioning that. We don't have the tools to do good planning. That's why we do bad planning. Bad planning in the sense that costs too much to all of us, the taxpayer.
And the future generation. Is it that we don't have the tools or we don't have the political will?
Well, both.
And okay, well, thank you. I'll go off and let you continue.
Thank you, Joanne, for the call, because, I mean, that was, she got my question before I asked you the question. But really, because we watch what happens that's based on political will and where that goes, the money often seems to follow.
So, if I may, the other tool that we are missing, that we advocate for 20 years and we still don't have it, it is land readjustment, land pooling, like the Japanese or the German system or the Swedish system. That was advocated by the leadership in Kalihi-Palama well before the neighborhood board were invented, because there was some small landowner that realized that they needed to pull their small property to allow urban renewal, urban infill, would have benefited them. But that would not have benefited at all the large landowner, Bishop Estate, Campbell Estate, and the other two or three bigger estates. So that's why we didn't have, there was no political interest to create this tool that would have allowed urban renewal and the infill in Honolulu. If we would have had that, Central Oahu and Eva would not be suburbanized as it is now. The city will be compacted, more compact, but building not too high, no more than 12-story, 4 to 12-story, and also single family where it is needed. And so also the transit would have been only right here in town.
All right, we're going to take another caller. Henry calling us from the Pali. Aloha, Henry. Hope you're on a hands-free there.
Yes. You just were discussing the question of political will and money.
Go ahead.
I suggest that our political will follows the money.
Well, let's see. Jennifer is shaking her head at that. Let me see if she can give you an answer to that. So which way is it? Is it, as we suggested a moment ago, that political will and the money follows it, or the other way around?
Well, I don't disagree with Henry. I mean, money is powerful. But what I am hopeful about in terms of Hawaii and our many communities is that we have numerous instances in which money doesn't carry the day in really important kinds of land use conflicts and really important kinds of political controversies. So, of course, the caller of Hawaii makes me sort of proud that the debate over GMO, regardless of where you stand on the issue, at the very least, it shows you cannot buy an election out and out. At least you cannot buy every election out and out. And I absolutely agree. It's a combination of tools available and the political organizing to use it. And I think there are really powerful and impressive instances. For example, you know, Molokai, a place that, you know, I've spent some time and really admire the folks there because they can organize. And when they organize, they use the tools to their fullest up against really powerful inequalities and the money.
Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're having a spirited discussion about urban planning and growth on Oahu. We want to hear from you, too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And you have to jump back in here. You've been quiet there for a little while. As you've been listening to the conversation that we've been having and some of the suggestions of what we should have done way back when, which now is impossible because, you know, we can't step into the Wayback Machine and suddenly dial back and it's, you know, 1960 again. Are we stuck?
So I was thinking about two different things. One is that, you know, I am actually originally a history student. And so looking at sort of what were the different pieces that led to the today, right? So federal highways, H1, H2, H3, thinking about how that is echoed in communities all over the United States in terms of how does urban sprawl get created. This idea that home ownership is a good citizen's duty and right, right? And that leading to this idea of the subdivision and the single family home. The Wayback Machine, instead of thinking of that as inevitable, just that it was always going to turn out this way, I think looking at history allows us to see how contingent, I know Jennifer really thinks about this a lot as well, that some of these current day situations are not sort of unstoppable juggernauts, but in fact are coming together, they're a coalescing of very different factors. And so one thing that I think I was thinking about as everyone was talking was this idea that part of what we need is the sense of what is possible, right? What is within the realm of the possible? And I think, you know, something that I sort of hold my profession, aka urban planning, kind of to fault for is that we haven't done a good enough job of really reaching out and kind of educating broadly about planning, both as, you know, in terms of processes, in terms of systems. I think a lot of times people will react to a situation, right? They'll react to a development that they think is a bad one. I remember back a few years ago, the Purple Spot out in the West Side, you know, obviously Ho'opili, various smaller developments, you know, single buildings, but there isn't a sense of the larger picture, right? How do these systems work? What are the points of intervention that could possibly change things? Even going to the TOD meetings, and I appreciate that the city has been trying hard to actually go into communities, right, after hours, after work. But, you know, there's the jargon flies thick and furious. Oh, this is a community benefits agreement. This is FAR, floor area ratio. This will be a density bonus. And, you know, I'm trained in this. I know it. But even I was sort of overwhelmed by the sheer density of jargon.
Yeah, so that makes people's just eyes glaze over and realize how much they don't know, and they simply walk away and don't participate in the process.
Yes. So I'm thinking, you know, that around sort of opportunities like transit-oriented development and even the neighborhood board system and various other sort of structures that we have in place or processes that are happening, Ala Moana Beach Park, Blaisdell Center. I mean, there's all sorts of sort of different pieces and different projects that are happening. It's really a chance for us to think about sort of holistically, how do we create planning for the people? I mean, I think there's some really great models. There is a Citizens Planning Institute in Philadelphia. There's a Land Use Leadership Institute in Oregon. So just thinking about where are the moments that we can sort of do a broad-based education? So instead of this being an abstruse, hard-to-follow conversation, people feel that they know what's possible, that they have both the information they need, and then they can actually do input.
All right, let's ask them. If you had the opportunity to find out more about urban planning for your area and just in general, how the system works and how it could work better, would you avail yourself of that opportunity? Does this mean enough to you to where you want to be able to learn more about it without a lot of the jargon and a lot of the issues that seem to just conflate the issue of urban planning and make it somewhat unintelligible? Annie Coe is saying that there are ways to do that, but that there has to be the will and there has to be the follow through. And with everything else that's on your plate, and you may want to, knock the system now and again, how things have been developed, but here we are with it. What are we going to do from this point forward? We want to hear from you. 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. Going to Mark calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Mark. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello. I used to live in Ever Beach, and they had a blast zone around the Naval Weapons Station. I think it's called Lu'ulu'ule. It was sugarcane and I think maybe golf courses, but now it's all suburban. And what happened that allowed them to collapse that blast zone? The Naval Weapons Station is still there. I remember they had a huge disaster, I think, in the 50s. And, that's my question.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
The only things I know that there is a blast zone that is indicated in the map that don't allow development. I don't know then what happened.
What the reasons were for that, but that's been that way for a very, very long time.
Yeah, but can we go back to what the caller from Kauai hinted about governance?
Sure, go ahead.
The caller from Kauai hinted to the lack of good governance here. And I feel the same, particularly for the city and county of Honolulu. I think our local community are disenfranchised. In many other states and countries, small communities have the power to govern themselves. They have a mayor, councilman, they have power of taxation, they have their own police. So for local things, they have some degree of autonomy. We don't have it here in the city and county of Honolulu. We have the neighborhood board, which is a great thing. But people get discouraged because they are not taken into much consideration. In the 70s, I passed on information that in my hometown in Milano, there was a discretionary budgeting. These small municipalities, even in the urban area, could spend some of the money as they wanted for their need. If the neighborhood board representative would have the opportunity to spend some money for what is needed there, much more interest in governance, much more expertise and talent and voluntarism would come in. Under the previous administration, there was an attempt here to provide a little money for communities and so on. However, they didn't really figure out well the collaboration between this voluntary group doing local project and the neighborhood board that was the first level of elected representative. But that formula could be redone much better. And to really promote better planning, she mentioned community benefit agreement. I don't think there is a way out. We have to establish a process for real community benefit agreement, which are three-party agreement. So big government, big developer, and the community really negotiate a contract that a legal standing in the USA is done in other places, particularly for transit-oriented development. There is a material written on it that would engage our citizenship more in co-planning the city, because let's not be afraid about planning. We all live in the city. We are all experts. We know what does mean to go to work, to school, to the hospital, to recreation. So everybody has an expertise and can participate. Thank you.
We've got a lot of callers on the line, and they want to respond to some of the things that you've been talking about, and I have some questions for you, too. We're going to try to get through everybody that we can. Harrison calling us from Honolulu. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Good afternoon, folks. Fascinating conversation. I was intrigued. It was good to hear first the mention of TOD. You know, this, I'm speaking on behalf of the City and County's TOD program, and you know, we certainly are working our tails off trying to correct some of the ills of the past and get development focused, very much like Luciana was talking about in the areas around TOD. But, you know, leaving that aside, people can look at the plans. I was intrigued by the suggestion that we need less plenaries and more citizen planning. We've done our best to get people to come to the workshops and really help understand what's going on. But I do confess I have had some, I've crafted some of those slideshows that mention technical terms like community benefits and things like that. So just wanted to put out there an idea that if listeners and members of the community are interested in more training like that, we did a lot of citizen planner training classes for neighborhood board members and other citizens about 15 years ago when I first came to the islands. I had founded the Citizen Planner Institute, and I guess about 20 years ago in Miami, we moved it here in 98. And we would be glad to refresh those courses and offer them to the community so that people can learn more about planning and more effectively participate in the process.
Well,
if anybody wants a camera on that, you can go to our, either send it through HBR or go to our Facebook page at TOD Honolulu and comment if you want of those kind of classes.
All right, Harrison, twice today I got to talk to you, this morning when you were on the program, and thanks for calling tonight.
Take care.
Thank you. Aloha.
Can I jump in briefly?
Please do.
Okay.
Annie,
so I am fully cognizant of how hard participatory planning is, right? You send out the media announcement, you're not sure who's going to come, people come. There's the language access issue. I mean, I think I talked with Harrison about outreach in the Kalihi Palama area, Kapalama area in terms of Tagalog and Ilocano, and a lot of it's relationship building. And I think this is someplace that, you know, maybe more so than other places, really it matters about the relationship, right? It matters that you got news about something through the coconut wireless from somebody that you trust. And so, you know, I think a lot of this is just being patient, that maybe the first three times you invite someone, you know, you went to the Vietnamese church to try to reach to the Vietnamese community, but you went and they're like, who are you? That you go again, they still are like, oh, I think I saw you last week. And you go a third time, and then maybe they're willing to sit down and find out why you're there. And so I think a lot of this is really, you know, being honest that it's not easy, that even with the best intentions, you can still fall down on the job in terms of doing outreach and bringing people to a public meeting and then getting creative. Because honestly, man, I mean, this is literally what I do, and I can't stand so many public meetings because, you know, it's that sort of formula of sort of watch and then walk away.
All right. Well, we have a lot of people who have walked our way and are now on the phone, and we want to make sure we can get through all of these calls. Going now to Stuart calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Stuart, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. No, good to hear you guys talking. I was just interviewing Senator Schatz's wife, Linda, who used to work for Kamehameha Schools, about a film, for a film about Kakako called Third City. And one of the things we keep on coming up against everyone we interview is saying, oh, yeah, once rail is, you know, in effect, there won't be these, you know, these traffic problems, and it'll be live, you know, play and work, you know, where you live. And the only problem is that, you know, we're still talking, this is 10 years down the line, and we have, you know, either the worst or the second worst traffic in the country. And I think people are getting to the point where they're saying, you know, enough. They're so frustrated with the traffic situation. And, you know, I kind of building on what you guys were saying earlier about, you know, using the jargon. And I've heard so many people say, oh, well, yeah, there are going to be 20,000 new kind of residents coming to the area, but the traffic won't increase. Our studies show that they won't. I'm like, the common person says that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't add up. So I would just ask you guys maybe to comment on, you know, the developments in Kakako, and if you do this community, you know, benefits agreements, like how would that look like for the people so they really could participate more, people who are interested and engaged?
All right, we're going to take it there. Thanks, Stuart, for the call. Just be brief in your answer so that maybe we can get a few more callers in who want to ask you some questions too. So how would you do it? Comment on Kaka'ako, and how would you do it, Annie? And you know well because you're down there a lot.
Yes. Just two quick thoughts. One is that we're often so optimistic about the impact of rail and sort of mass transit developments that we overestimate how well it will work. So I think that's a little bit of what's going on, that we want it to work so badly that we overestimate. And then two, I think community planning in terms of thinking about what do the residents, do the people who work and have businesses down in Kaka'ako really see as possible? And I know that with Karen Umemoto, another faculty member at UH, we'll be looking at this very this fall in a community planning class. So no specific answer now, but that, you know.
One may be coming.
Yes.
All right, Jennifer.
I think the story of Kaka'ako Makai is really interesting in that question because there you had a small group of dedicated residents and users that mobilized and made significant changes. They enacted legislation in 2006 that literally rewrote what could be done with Kaka'ako Makai. Of course, not everyone agrees with it. And they created space for a citizens advisory committee that did really important work. But I think the broader point that I really would like to underscore what Luciano Minerbi has said is the importance of it not just being consultation, but giving participants and citizens and community groups authority and real spending power, not just tell us your vision and we may or may not listen
to it.
Not
just lip service. Okay. All right. We're going to go to a few more callers. Jeff calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, Jeff. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You guys have hit so many topics that I'd love to talk about. First off, rail. I hope that we don't go rail crazy. It did almost bankrupt Portland when they went into their third phase of it. But my main question for you is, when Alexander and Baldwin bought out all of the property in Kailua, there's an article in the newspaper that said about 80% of the property was useless. And I thought it was a strange article that a publicly traded company would buy something that was useless. Yes, the city portion of Kailua is worth a tremendous amount of money, but do you think that they're going to go forward and try to do some creative zoning changes and start developing all of these areas that were supposedly going to be left untouched?
All right. Thanks very much, Jeff, for your question.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
You too.
Thanks.
Does anybody have any familiarity with that issue entirely? I'm getting some heads shaking around here. I'm sorry, Jeff. We're going to have to leave that one alone, but we're going to move on to Cliff calling us from Nu'uanu. Aloha, Cliff. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. I just want to make the point that if you're going to talk about urban planning, and given the fact that the rail is so unpopular at the moment, that we should really look back to the very beginnings of the rail planning and try to ensure that that doesn't happen again in our other planning, such as loading up the neighborhood boards with city employees all the way along to the way the money was loaded up on Governor Caetano when he was running for mayor. From start to finish, the city and every aspect of rail, okay, were misleading the public on the benefits that they talked about. They led people to believe that there would be traffic reduction. They never explicitly said so. And actually, if you look at their numbers, it's very, very clear that it's going to be much greater traffic congestion in the future with rail than there is today.
So Cliff, the
big thing is to review that early planning from over the last 10 years.
All right, I want to get the group in here because he's making the point of let's not make the same mistake again if you see this as being a mistake and there are other issues out there that we don't want to have those replicated. Do you see any issues that might be analogous to what he's describing with rail?
Well, we can see what went wrong. Everything went wrong with rail. Should have been done the other way around. Should have started from urban Honolulu proper, the portion already built, the portion that had already people and workers and housing, and facilitate slow way public transit with all mode of transportation from trolley, buses, and so on, maybe a light rail on Yonge Street to serve the urban Honolulu to downtown. And then move from the central Honolulu, serving first Waikiki, the university, downtown, and the airport, and then expanding from there toward Eva. That would have been sound planning. Instead, we did sound real estate speculation, and we started from
you're getting a lot of heads netting around this table. I'm watching
well
this.
Put.
All right, we're going to take one more caller. Glenn calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Glenn. Thanks for your patience.
Yes, I've lived here all my life, and I go back to the days when Honolulu was just over 100,000 people. The Hawaii that was then is the Hawaii that is advertised. That was when everything was balanced. You know, I've been working with the city when I was in my prime. With the Fosse administration, we tried to build parks. And I found myself in the middle of this cacophony of this and that and this solution and that problem. And I have to say that the problem that is generating all of these problems is overpopulation on this island. It is now over 1 million people, and I've seen our greatest agricultural plain, the Waihewa Plain, one of the 10 most fertile plains in the world, now being paved over with homes and roads and malls.
Okay, but Glenn, let me stop you there. I mean, how do you tell somebody you can't move here?
That's right. That's the problem. It's a subject that nobody wants to talk about, but it is the driving problem that is going to make all these other solutions just temporary. It's overpopulation, and what's going to happen when you build that extra road?
All right,
that
Glenn.
Mass transit, that other mall, that other subdivision, mm-hmm. It's going to get bigger. And I'm telling you,
well, you're kind of making Luciano's point.
Let me say, I've been observing that the people on the mainland, in Asia, and everywhere else, especially Canada, they look at Hawaii as a great place to bring up a family, and that is what's happening right now.
All right, we've got to stop you there because we're almost at the end of the hour. You know, he makes the point that we hear every single time that we talk about growth and urban planning, that we have too many people, But the bottom line of it is you're not going to be able to stop somebody from coming here. People have the ability and the right to move from state to state. What are you going to do?
Of course, we are a state of USA, so people and money can come in. However, something could have been done in the past. Instead of building the convention center right here in...
down the street from our
studio,
right?
Down the street could have been done on the neighbor island.
Okay, so guys, but here we are right now. And
on the big island.
We've talked about so many things where things went wrong. And I know earlier I asked you, Annie, if we're stuck, and you said, no, we've got some opportunities left. Where we are right now, I want to go very, very quickly. Two words. What could be done to make it different right now?
I think embrace the messiness. We want urban planning to be a science with exactness, but it's not. So embrace the messiness and start talking as much as possible.
And engage.
Engage.
That's the message I heard from all of you. I wish we had more time, but we are going to actually have more time to talk because on Monday, we're going to all get together at the Harris United Methodist Church, and Kukua Council is going to sponsor another run at this conversation. So if you didn't have your question answered today, hopefully we will see you next Monday at 11:30, and we'll post some more information about that so we can have your input, too. Thanks so very much to Professor Luciano Minerbi, to Annie Koh, and to Jennifer Dara Okike for being here. We'll all get together next week, and I'll see you tomorrow morning for The Conversation. Aloha.